you ask the man in the street what's driving Alzheimer's, they'll probably say a third is in the genes, or that it's just what happens when you age. Now, neither of these statements are strictly true. Alzheimer's is a largely preventable disease, and my guests today are tackling the two fundamental questions. Firstly, what are the positive and negative behaviors, diet, lifestyle, environment, that both either drive dementia or prevent it? And then the big question is, how do you encourage people to change those behaviors? Firstly, I'm going to talk with Assistant Professor Tommy Wood from the University of Washington about the what, and then Dr. Christina Curtis, a behavioral scientist and honorary lecturer at the University College London, who heads the Applied Behavior Change team, about how to affect behavior change. So, Tommy, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, your background in relation to the brain is broad. I see from your time at Cambridge, then Oxford University, then Norway, and now Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Neuroscience at the University of Washington. I believe you've also brain-trained Formula One drivers. Tell us about your background and how you became involved in this challenge to prevent Alzheimer's.
I essentially fell into neuroscience initially around 20 years ago when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge. I spent a summer in a neonatal neuroscience lab looking at brain injury in babies. This is still what I do partly 20 years later. In between, I then went to medical school. I trained as a doctor. And I also had a lot of interest in other neurodegenerative conditions. So, for instance, I spent a lot of time looking at a systems approach to multiple sclerosis because my stepbrother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when he was a similar age to me in my mid-20s. And then, as I worked through my PhD and my early sort of formal academic career as a professor, I worked increasingly with athletes as a performance consultant. So anything related to their cognitive and physical performance could be sleep, diet, other stresses that they are frequently exposed to. And so as this story comes together in my career, I work with brain injury at the beginning of life. As I work with athletes, I do more around concussions and traumatic brain injury. And then you think, well, there are all these factors that start early in life, probably even before you're born, that create this trajectory of how your brain functions, and that continues as you get older. So then that makes me think about, well, how do we intervene at any life stage to ensure that we have cognitive function that lasts as long as possible, ideally preventing significant cognitive decline and dementia in old age. And you start to see that these same risk factors are important at every stage, and you can start to build this idea of what the brain needs, and then you can figure out how you might want to intervene.
I was just interviewing Professor Michael Crawford, age 93, and using sort of quantum physics, he's worked out how the photons that hit our eye turn into the image that we actually see. And I remember at the same age, 93, filming Linus Pauling on his theory of lipoprotein A. So I've witnessed people well into their 90s as sharp as a razor. I don't think we need to get this thing. But before that, a little bit of background. What is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia overall? And we also hear about vascular dementia.
Dementia is essentially a catch-all diagnosis for when an individual has reached a point of cognitive decline where they are no longer able to perform regular daily tasks or usually look after themselves. So it's a clinical diagnosis based on overall cognitive functioning. Then you might ask, well, what's causing this dementia in an individual? And then we have these subcategories. So Alzheimer's dementia, which if you asked Alzheimer himself, apparently he was unsure whether they should all be classified as the same thing. But that's a sort of like a semantic argument. But what we would call Alzheimer's clinically makes up maybe 60 to 80% of dementia. Vascular dementia, which is more directly focused on blood supply to the brain, makes up something like 5 to 10%. And then there are other other related or other dementias that have very sp or affect very specific parts of the brain. But overall, their effect on broad cognitive function eventually ends up in a similar place. With the different type of dementias, you may have a different clinical picture. So with Alzheimer's dementia, it's often thought to be this continuous gradual decline in function, whereas with vascular dementia, what is often thought to happen is you have these very small strokes that happen throughout the brain, and each time that happens, you lose a portion of function, so you have more of this step change over time. However, in reality, there tends to be lots of overlap between, say, vascular and Alzheimer's dementia, because blood supply to the brain is also important for Alzheimer's, and sometimes it can be difficult to differentiate between the two.
And how is Alzheimer's diagnosed as ex, you know, in that form of dementia?
Usually, it's going to involve some cognitive function tests. So there is lots of standardized tests like the MoCA, MMSE. People may have heard of these, but there's a whole range of tests that you're usually going to do in person with a neurologist or an old age psychiatrist. And part of it is going to be a diagnosis of exclusion. So you want to make sure that somebody doesn't have something else going on, like some very significant vitamin deficiencies or other things or significant depression. They can look like significant cognitive decline or dementia, but they aren't necessarily the same thing. So part of it is going to be excluding these other causes. And then you'll probably do some brain scans. You'll look at the how the brain looks, either on a CT scan or an MRI. And then that in conjunction with cognitive function and some part of the medical history is going to tell you this is likely Alzheimer's dementia.
And often we hear of someone being diagnosed with mixed dementia. Is that mainly part Alzheimer's, part vascular?
Yes, that's the commonest combination. But if you think about Lewy body dementia or frontotemporal dementia, these can also occur in different combinations in different people. But usually, because of the overlap in terms of the risk factors, Alzheimer's with some vascular component is relatively common.
Now, if a person could change all their circumstances, and we're sort of talking from early life as well, their diet, their lifestyle, their environment that they're born into, and their education, to what extent could we say that Alzheimer's is a preventable disease?
It depends on how you want to try and tackle the question. But if you can change everything about an individual's circumstances other than their genetics, then the vast majority is preventable. Depending on who you ask, some will say that it's maybe 40 to 50%. Others will say that it's up to maybe 70 to 80%. In some populations around the world, usually hunter-gatherer or in indigenous populations, dementia is almost entirely unheard of. So it's definitely possible that there are some combinations of environment and genetics where dementia just doesn't occur. And in that scenario, it is entirely preventable.
Now, do these same prevention steps, which obviously we're going to go into, also prevent vascular dementia? And if so, if we put Alzheimer's and vascular and a chunk of mixed dementia together, are we talking about 80% of dementias, for example, being potentially 80% preventable?
Yes. So like I mentioned briefly earlier, there's a lot of overlap between the risk factors for vascular dementia, and those are also related to cardiovascular disease risk factors. So things that affect your body's ability to move blood to the places that you want it to move, the health of your blood vessels. And there's a lot of overlap between those risk factors or things that affect that negatively and those that are risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, cardiovascular disease and poor vascular health are risk factors for Alzheimer's dementia more directly. So if we think about the upper end of the subcategories of dementias, are 80% is Alzheimer's disease, 10% is vascular dementia, which sort of based on estimates, that could be up to 90%. And then in modern Westernized populations, 70 to 80% of that is preventable. Then yes, 90% of dementias are probably at least 70-ish to 80-ish percent preventable.
Now, It's often said that early onset Alzheimer's, which is defined as before the age of 65, is that small genetic part. But a study that came out earlier this year questioned that. It was on the basis of data from the UK Biobank. And it actually said that many of the same factors that are driving dementia Alzheimer's later in life are also present in those who develop a diagnosis before 65. So even that sort of de-emphasizes the genes to some extent. Is this true? Early onset is much the same phenomena that we're looking at?
Yes and no. So traditionally, early onset Alzheimer's, which is thought to be almost entirely genetic, and it's driven by single significant high penetrance genetic mutations that result in early cognitive decline in Alzheimer's dementia, which is thought to be more similar to what Alzheimer himself was describing when he first described the disease. That originally was thought to maybe be 5-10% of dementia, or 5-10% of Alzheimer's disease. Now, as Alzheimer's disease has become more prevalent, it's maybe around 1% of cases. However, I certainly know clinicians who have patients who have one of these mutations, like in a presenilin gene or in the amyloid precursor protein gene. And by attending to lifestyle factors, they manage to maintain good cognitive function late into life. So even if you have some of these mutations, which are thought to almost definitively lead to Alzheimer's disease and early in life, there does seem to be an interaction with lifestyle and other health related factors. And then at the same time, we're seeing earlier diagnosis of non-monogenic Alzheimer's disease, which is what this paper you described was talking about. And that's probably because the health of the population is declining, such that we're seeing pre-diabetes earlier, we're seeing people are less physically active, maybe they're less cognitively stimulated, and all these other risk factors are adding up, and they're affecting our brains earlier in life. So now there's more of a mix in that early onset Alzheimer's disease as those risk factors become prevalent earlier in life.
I saw a report from China of a man aged 19 diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It said non-genetic, so presumably they had tested and there wasn't the AP gene or the presenilin gene. I can't confirm that. But can it really happen that fast, this cognitive decline that we are seeing so prevalent?
If you think about cognitive function as a trajectory over time, there are 3 or 4 different components to that. So first of all, as you get older, usually into your mid-20s or early 30s, it's generally cognitive function generally peaks on average towards the end of your formal period of education. So if that education extends into university or maybe a graduate degree, then that's going to peak sometime in your 20s or early 30s. But if you don't even complete secondary school or high school, then it's going to peak much earlier and it's going to have a much lower peak. After the peak, then you have a period of decline, and that the speed of that decline depends on a number of factors, the majority of them related to ongoing stimulus to the brain, as well as a whole host of health-related and nutritional factors, as you know very well. So there's certainly a possibility where if you had a low peak of cognitive function, and that may even be based on like maternal nutrition and epigenetics related to the health of your parents. So you had a low peak and you have poor overall health, you have a more rapid decline. It's certainly possible that this could happen very early in life, though thankfully, at least right now, that's very rare.
Yeah, we've seen the youngest age of type 2, adult onset diabetes used to be called age 3. So it's quite extraordinary. So is Alzheimer's just the tip of the iceberg of a growing tsunami of cognitive decline that is likely to start happening earlier?
Yes and no. And I say no because having had lots of conversations, including with one of your close colleagues and mentors, David Smith, when you look at age specific prevalence of Alzheimer's disease, it has not increased over time. In fact, it's actually in some populations, it's decreased, and it's probably decreased a little bit more in men because we focused very heavily on cardiovascular disease risk factors, which are more important in men in terms of causes of death. And that has come with some improvement in terms of age-specific incidence of Alzheimer's disease. When the reason why Alzheimer's disease is becoming more prevalent and it's going to double or triple in the next few decades is because we're living longer. So there's a combination of we're living longer and in general, our health is declining. So you could say there's this oncoming wave of Alzheimer's disease and that is expected. But we know that if we target specific risk factors, that doesn't have to be the case. So I don't think it's all bad news.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, you're the principal investigator at Food for the Brain, heading the research and the science there. So, what does that involve? What's your goal as principal investigator?
One of the most important tools that we have when we're looking at diseases or, say, specific functions or health of the population are population data sets. And there are lots of these that are organized by governments around the world. There's NHANES in the US, there's UK Biobank in the UK that people have heard of. And you collect lots of data from lots of people, and you can start, at that kind of scale, you can start to maybe pick up relationships that you couldn't otherwise. And you can have a lot more data than if you did like a randomized controlled trial or something like that. However, when people but like and this is something that's very common. If you do science, what happens is that you create a study or you start collecting data, and then you get to the end and you start to look at it and you're like, oh, there are all these things that I wish that I'd collected that I hadn't collected. And when we think about risk factors for cognitive decline and dementia specifically, none of the data sets that exist so far are really designed to focus on that. So one of the most important ideas is to collect data specifically related to risk factors for Alzheimer's dementia, and hopefully those that are modifiable. So this and it's kind of a citizen science idea, right? We're going to people who are interested in this, or maybe interested in this for their loved ones. They are providing their data. Part of it is to help understand their own risk, but then giving us the opportunity to look at a wide variety of risk factors. So eventually there's going to be blood tests involved. There are hundreds of questions in a questionnaire that look at different risk factors of the cognitive function test. So then when you have very large data sets like this, we can start to look for complex interactions between risk factors, and we can figure out which risk factors are most important. These are things that are still need to be done as it pertains to most Alzheimer's disease. And I think hopefully, Food for the Brain is going to be in a good position to help people understand that.
But those who are not familiar with Food for the Brain, we have a validated cognitive function test, which over 400,000 people have done, and then a questionnaire about your diet and lifestyle and various factors, which include, or let's say, are organized into eight domains. This includes sugar and what we call a low glycemic load diet. It includes B vitamins, which are very important in relation to homocysteine. It includes questions about your intake of antioxidants and polyphenols, about healthy gut, but also gums and dental health. Then active mind and socialization, but this includes things about your senses, your hearing, your vision, which are also very important. And also active body, not just aerobic, if you like, cardio exercise, but also building muscle, which I know is one of your major areas of interest, Tommy. And also sleep and stress. And every now and again, you jump in and help us tweak the questions a little bit better. And then this year, we've introduced three tests. One is the blood test for homocysteine, which indicates one's sort of B vitamin status and effect, HbA1c, a measure of blood sugar, omega-3 and vitamin D. So that's the data that we're collecting. And you're the guy that's helping us to look at that data. Now, the interesting thing is that the usual way of doing research is to pick one thing you want to improve, such as cognitive function in this case, and then change one thing, be it exercise or supplementing fish oils or whatever it is, with a control group to check that the effect is real. But life isn't quite like that, is it? It's multifactorial. So what's the difference in this approach at Food for the Brain? And could it even be nowadays that we're in this big data world that the effect of a randomized controlled trial is then to put it into that big mess of humanity with lots of variables and see what happens? Different approach, huh?
Yeah, there are now several examples, particularly related to cognitive function and dementia, where we know that risk factors are not this, where you sort of like this single variable problem. And so you mentioned omega-3s. There are several trials now where they've given omega-3s and they've hoped to slow cognitive decline or prevent dementia, and they haven't seen the result they expected. In a traditional scientific method, they would throw their hands up in the air and say, well, omega-3s don't work, therefore we should do something else. But there are multiple randomized controlled trials now that show that omega-3 status is important in the context of B vitamin status. So if you have one or the other that is sort of below what you need, then the other won't work. But if you have both, or you improve both, or you have a good status of one and you improve the other, then you see a significant benefit. There are similar things. There was a study done here at the University of Washington that showed if you had good B vitamin status, then air pollution was less of a risk factor for you as a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. We know that if you have poor sleep, some of your poor sleep is offset if you do a lot of physical activity in terms of how it affects your brain and health. So these things are not one variable that you can change one at a time. Although if we find some relationships and we want to show the world that they're real, you would have to do some kind of controlled study, but you would maybe personalize that based on all the risk factors a person has and then just intervene on the ones that they could improve on. And that's, there are new trial methodologies where you can do that. And you can also randomize people to multiple different things over time and see whether they respond. So I think that's going to be part of what happens in the future. And hopefully we can build some of the evidence base that drives some of those studies. But also when you have these large data sets, you can do more complex statistics where essentially you just let the model tell you where these relationships are and where the interactions are. So we don't have to assume that we know what they are, and the data can kind of tell us that. And you can do that with these big data sets. So that's hopefully some of what we'll be doing as well.
So what's your ultimate goal from this data set? To find those that sort of perfect diet lifestyle combo?
I think that there are two main things. In reality, I think that we know what is going to be best for most people. I think we probably, if we look across all the evidence, we probably know that already. We could have a good guess of what you should aim for. Part of it is going to be understanding how these different things interact. Figuring out what's most important. When you go, and we'll get to this more later, when you go to somebody and you say, here are the 50 things you need to fix to improve your brain health, there's just an overwhelming amount of information. You don't know where to start. What should I do first? What's most important to me? What's most impactful? I think figuring out which factors an individual should focus on first, like where the lowest hanging fruit or the biggest bang for their buck is, like that's going to be a big part of this. And then one thing that's really important to me that hopefully we can get from this data set is building a big model of how the brain works, for want of a better phrase. Like what are all these inputs? How do they relate to one another? Can we figure out this whole system or take a systems approach to preventing cognitive decline? And that's really only something that you can build a theoretical model. But if you want to test it, you need data like these. And that's hopefully something we can do.
So when we find those sort of press points that are going to make all the biggest difference, then the sort of million-dollar question is, how do you actually change a person's often highly entrenched behavior, especially if we want to reach hundreds of thousands across a digital platform?
Having spent 20 years in these various health-related arenas, I've come to realize, just like I just said, that most of the information we need already exists. People usually don't need more information. They know they need to sleep better, they could eat better, they could move more. But getting them to do that and making behavior change, be a part of that to drive those new behaviors, that's where the real impact occurs. And then luckily we have experts in that, like Christina, who can help us, because we will generate better information, I'm confident of that. But unless people can actually act on it and make changes in their own lives, it's not going to be as useful as we would want it to be.
So, Dr. Christina Curtis, welcome. You're a behavior change expert and an associate of UCL's Center of Behavior Change and founder of Applied Behavior Change, which focuses on digital health programs to help prevent and manage chronic conditions. Can you explain a bit about your background and the reason you are interested and involved in this Alzheimer's prevention project?
Sure. Thanks, Patrick, for having me here today. After my psychology degree, I had a few years actually out working in industry because I hadn't really found the area in psychology that I wanted to specialise in. And during this time, there really was two pivotal moments that led me to, I guess, where I am today. And the first one happened when I was actually organising an event for the Department of Health and the World Health Organization on what was called then kind of non-communicable diseases. And this was back in 2008. And academics from all over the world were flown in to London to talk about the growing prevalence of these and that they were largely preventable by changing our health-related behaviours. Now, I was just organising the event at this time, but I listened to all these talks and I was absolutely gobsmacked, having not known anything about this before. And I became quite obsessed about this subject and read up in all my spare time. Meanwhile, during work, I started working in digital marketing and working with lots of clients like Cancer Research UK, developing campaigns to essentially change behaviour. And I became really fascinated in actually how can we use the digital medium as a tool to support people to make healthier habits and reduce unhealthy ones. And so this then led to me returning to studies to specialise in the area of health psychology, which is all about health behaviours. And then later on, immediately afterwards, I then started a PhD, which really was culminating my experience of back then, which was Web 2 technology, with my academic knowledge of health psychology at the Institute of Digital Healthcare at Warwick University. And my PhD was really focused on how do we embed behaviour change models into mobile health apps and digital health interventions. And the particular case study was supporting childhood weight management. And since then, I've been working in really the intersection between academia and practice. So I've been working in public health and consultancy with organizations and digital health organizations that have applied, where I've really applied the behavioral design method that I came up with during my PhD to other areas in terms of preventing and self-managing other chronic conditions such as diabetes. And really, I feel passionate about preventing chronic conditions and particularly Alzheimer's disease, as I think particularly with this condition, there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And we've talked a lot about them today in terms of many people thinking really it's a symptom of aging and largely down to our genes. Whereas, as we've heard, we can do actually a lot to reduce our risk by adopting healthier habits.
And what are you doing in the Cognition Project at Food for the Brain? What's your game plan?
Okay, yeah, sure. So let's talk about kind of preventative behaviours. So such as sort of increasing physical activity, eating a healthier diet, social interaction, brain training. These may all help to reduce our risk of developing things like Alzheimer's and dementia. However, we are yet to know really the true impact, as Tommy was talking about, of these behaviours alone or in combination. And one of the issues here is that actually sustaining these long-term change, these healthier habits in these areas is extremely challenging. There is quite a good evidence base of which behavior change techniques, and these really are the active ingredients of an intervention that directly bring about change on what drives our behaviors. So in other words, they are the kind of, once translated, they're the practical methods that help us shift our habits and behaviours towards healthier habits, such as kind of tracking what we're eating, social support and things like that. But we're still really in the early stages of understanding how to implement these techniques in a way that engage different groups of people. There is strong evidence suggests that we should have a tailored approach, which is important for engaging and behavior change. But the challenge still remains on how can we actually tailor behavior change approaches to support different behaviors at scale. So in terms of how we're going to achieve this for Food for the Brain, really the current research is aiming to address one of these eight domains that you've talked about. So starting with one at a time to understand the existing behavior change content that's currently offered in the cognition program. And how can this be improved for maximum impact on engagement and sustained behavior change? Now we know for the past few decades of public health campaigns that information alone is not enough to change behavior. Often we know what's good for us, what we need to do, but actually embedding that into our life, not just once, but consistently, is really difficult. So it has to be more than just one approach. Okay, it has to be more than just an educational strategy, but there has to be other strategies in place to support that behavior change. So the current research really is going to be looking at how can we best optimize the behavior change content that's coming out from Food for the Brain and the cognition program to understand what are people's preferences on how this behavior change content is delivered to them, whether it's delivered through a chatbot, for example, or a Zoom meeting. So we can both start to optimize, but also tailor this content for its members, which is going to be key.
Now let's take a concrete area such as physical activity, both cardiovascular or aerobic and resistance exercise, building muscle, which is an area that Tommy is particularly focused on. How do you get a couch potato up and out or an older person to engage in the importance of building muscle mass? And perhaps just before we ask you that question, Tommy, to what extent is something specific like building muscle having an effect on cognition and prevention of dementia? Just to understand, why we want to achieve something like that.
Me and some of the groups that I work with, we've done some research in this, as have others, that basically show particularly low muscle mass is a risk factor for cognitive decline and dementia. But more importantly, actually, the muscle mass is the strength that you have, so that you have some function with that muscle mass. So how strong are you, and how strong you are relative to your own body size, which is different for everybody. So you can kind of scale it that way and make it fair. That is a very good predictor of cognitive function after you take into account physical activity, education level, homocysteine, all these other things. And we've published on that and shown that. So we know that having functional or strong muscles is important, and that's probably because it's this neuromuscular stimulus. So it's you're stimulating your brain as you learn to move your muscles. And when you move your muscles, you improve a whole number of things like blood sugar control, and you release some factors that may be good for the brain, like brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Physical activity by improving muscle mass or strength has a number of different ways that it can positively affect the brain. It can sound very daunting to start. So particularly when people who haven't done a lot of physical activity themselves, we can zoom out a bit and say that we know, or we think we know, that there's a minimum effective dose for physical activity in terms of how it can improve cognitive function. And it's probably somewhere around the average government guidelines of physical activity, 150 minutes a week of moderate to vigorous physical activity. And that's important because it is immediately, particularly if you're starting out, it's tailorable. So there's this, there's intensity and time both matter. So if you like gardening, you could do an hour of gardening a day and you reach your goal in terms of the amount of physical activity that can significantly improve cognitive function. If you happen to like sprinting, you could do 5 minutes of sprinting a day and you achieve that same amount of energy expenditure or intensity of exercise that significantly improves cognitive function. So then anywhere on that spectrum, maybe it's 20 to 30 minutes of brisk walking a day, you're also going to hit that goal. And we know from multiple studies that If you say take individuals who are in their 60s and 70s and you ask them to walk briskly for 40 minutes three times a week, a year later, we see significant improvements in their brain structure. The same with resistance training. So if we take individuals in their 70s, this was done in the SMART trial, and you give them a resistance training program where twice a week they go into the gym for 45 minutes and they do four machines for three sets of eight repetitions, we see a significant improvement in cognitive function, and the structure of their brain improves in areas that are at risk or that change over time associated with Alzheimer's disease. So you can pick and choose based on your personal preference. And if that's where you're going to start, we know you're going to see a significant benefit.
So, Tommy, you make a very compelling case. And the question, Christina, is how do you get someone to adopt these kind of behaviors? And you can almost use me as an example. I'm 65. I'm reasonably active, hate gyms. I'm scanning around my office and my study, and I can see some weight bells, I can see some springs, I can see some bits of equipment that I've bought at some moment of enthusiasm, and then I think they get quite dusty. So, Christina, how do you get someone to do the very compelling things that Tommy's talking about as an example of behavior change?
Yeah, sure. Well, there are, as Tommy's also been saying, different preferences and strategies that work well for different people. So, as a first step, really, to behavior change, is trying to understand what are the particular barriers to the exercise for that person. So, if we take walking as an example, before we move on to you, of course, it's finding out what's stopping someone going for a walk. Is it to do with physical limitation? Is it because they've got disabilities? Is it because they believe, if they've got back pain, for example, they believe that if they go for a walk, they're going to make the pain worse? So it's really about kind of trying to diagnose what the kind of what's stopping them from actually wanting to perform the behavior. And you can do this by either asking them, but also testing out what works as well, because we know that often people say and do a different thing. So it's good to use a kind of mixed methods approach here. And then we try to address those different sources of influence on stopping them walking. And if we're talking about the digital sphere, things like pain rating scales have shown to be really effective. So when people start actually walking, they start then measuring, tracking their pain and see, well, actually, my pain's improving now I'm walking, and I actually thought it was the opposite. So people can start to experiment themselves with exercise and see, what works for them as well. Or it could be about, not having anyone to do some exercise with. And this is something that stops them doing it because actually they want feedback on what they're doing, or they want sort of social, moral support. And again, we've seen that digital buddy systems that have come into place where, even if you don't have someone, a friend nearby, it can connect you to people within your area to go for a walk with, for example. So the reach of digital health interventions are great that way. And we can deliver lots of different behavior change techniques based on that particular barrier or, particular set of barriers that a person may have. So for you, for example, again, I would want to know, well, what do you have? What resources do you have to carry out strength exercises such as weights? Okay, you've explained you do have some resources. So it's not that you don't have that. That's not the problem. It sounds like it's more around the motivational part in terms of you don't want to do it. And perhaps you're prioritizing other forms of things like, oh, well, I must get finished this book or, work. Often we prioritize work over exercise if it's something that isn't ingrained into our lives. So that's the key thing, is ensuring that we get into a habit of this
I think,
exercise.
yes, that's certainly one of my excuses, and it's probably quite common, which is I don't have the time. In other
Yes.
words, I've allocated my time for other things.
Yes. So what we normally do, in digital interventions is we start really simply with an action plan where you have to kind of schedule some time. So if you're going to do three times a week, a location, a time that you're going to do this exercise, and you have that scheduled in your diary no matter what. And by doing it in the same time, the same location each week, that repetition will start to form a habit. But then, as we know, there are going to be some barriers that will come into play, like, oh, well, my grandchildren came around today, so I couldn't do my exercise, or various things. So it's about also planning for those potential things that will stop us performing these exercises. Think about, okay, well, we'll do it on a different day, or actually, can I get my grandchildren involved in the exercise and make it more fun? And that's another key thing, is making exercise fun, we know, is really important for sustaining it as well. So it's about being creative.
Yeah, my wife's family are very exercise averse. I remember a few years ago, I bought her a bicycle for her birthday, and they were absolutely shocked. Considered definitely unsafe. Do not ride a bicycle, you know, etc. So it's interesting how sort of deeply ingrained these habits are. But the interesting, I remember someone told me the 3-6-36 rule. It may not be exactly right, but the idea was it takes 3 weeks to break a habit, 6 weeks to make a habit, and 36 weeks to hardwire a habit. So, you know, it's a bit like a meditation teacher said, you know, meditation, it's really no different. You know, you're focusing your mind always on whatever, you know, worrying about things and so on. It's just about where you focus your mind. So you can build bad habits, you can build good habits. And the challenge is, how do we help people to build good habits across a digital platform so we can reach not just hundreds of thousands, but millions?
Exactly.
Tommy, any parting words for you as we come towards the end of this podcast?
No, other than I'm very excited to be part of the team and food for the brain. And, you know, I think that we have the potential to make significant impact in this area. And I'm really looking forward to all of it.
And Christina, your closing statements?
Yeah, no, I just would agree with Tom. I'm really excited to be kicking things off. I think 2024 is going to be a really interesting year, and I look forward to collaborating with you all.
Well, it's been brilliant to have you here. I was at a meeting the other day of all the leading Alzheimer's dementia societies, and I had a sort of almost out-of-body experience, because they were all making very compelling cases. Some relative had died from this terrible disease. You see, my father-in-law at the moment, you know, he no longer has grandchildren. He doesn't remember them. He's getting close to the point of not remembering his children. You know, it's getting that bad. And yes, they all wanted more money. They wanted more hospital beds. They wanted more care in the community. They wanted, everything was very, very laudable. And I had this sort of out-of-body experience where I was looking down on this vast hospital from above, full of lemmings. And there was the Lemming Society and Lemming Research and Lemming this and Lemming that. Everyone trying to make life better for these poor people who are really, really suffering. And I called it the Lemdemic. And the caption was waiting for a cure. And then if you go up the cliff, there are a couple of radical lemmings who'd put up a sign, and all the other bewildered lemmings were staring at it. And the sign said, "Don't jump." And I think that's what we're trying to do, is to let people know. And the problem is, there is this gap in time. You know, if you ate something today and your memory went tomorrow, you'd kind of get the message. But we've got this gap in time that may be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So how to bring that awareness of prevention to many, many people. It's really a delight to have you in our team. And thank you very, very much for your time today on this podcast.
Thank you.